I want to follow up on something from the discussion, because in the break time a couple of people came to talk to me, and you know, the question came arose about giving people a second chance and accepting apologies and so on and so forth when people have harmed us. And so accepting genuine apologies is very important when people sincerely regret something. Yeah, we should definitely accept their apology. It does not necessarily mean we have to trust them in the same way as we trusted them before. We may want to be a little bit more cautious and to really see, you know, is their behavior changing and so on and so forth. So accepting apologies doesn't mean that you just forget about what happened. The same kind of thing with, you know, things that have happened in the world. Like, we may say, for example, the Holocaust, or the what happened during the Cultural Revolution in China. Maybe some of the people involved in those things apologize. You know, we should accept the apology. We should forgive the people involved. But that doesn't mean that forgiving does not mean what they did was okay. Okay, that's very important to understand. Forgiving does not mean what the other person did was okay. And forgiving does not mean we forget about it. Because especially in the case of different kinds of genocide and different harmful actions, we need to remember these kinds of things as a world community so that we don't repeat them. Okay. So forgiving means that we are not holding anger, we are not holding a grudge. Now, compassion, yeah, is often misunderstood, and people think with compassion, somebody brought it up, you know, that you become the world's doormat. Yeah, compassion, I'm just so good, I'm so kind, whatever you did, it's okay, I forgive you. I was at a conference some years ago, and one monk was talking about a woman whose husband, you know, kept mistreating her and abusing her and cheating on her and beating her, and how compassionate she was that, you know, she just kept letting him come back and, you know, and eventually they reconciled. And he's saying that, I'm going, wait, you don't understand what it's like for a woman to be beaten and for a woman, you know, to have her trust abrogated like that. Her, you know, forgiving him compassionately, I don't think was compassion. I think it was stupidity. Yeah. When somebody is acting in a harmful way, you need to say, that action is harmful. I am not, you know, allowing those circumstances to come about in my life again. And this is getting cut off. I couldn't believe that this monk was saying that. You know, he clearly had no experience. You know, that's why I think nuns need to teach sometimes, huh? Yeah, we know a little bit about what it's like on the receiving side of things. Yeah, and so, you know, when there's harm, you have every right, you know, and you need to say that is harmful. I'm not staying involved in that relationship, and I'm not going along with those kind of conditions that allow that to happen. Okay. And if somebody else is unhappy with you because you're not going along with the conditions that allow harm to happen, their unhappiness, their criticism of you is their problem. If you are acting with wisdom and you are acting to prevent harm, even the whole world tells you you're stupid and blah, 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 that doesn't make any difference. You have to do what is correct. Yeah. And so people may not like it. That is their problem. Okay? So we have to really understand what love and compassion mean, because we want everybody to be happy. We want everybody to be free of suffering. Okay? But that does not mean that everything people think they need to have in order to be happy is actually what they need to have. Okay, so somebody is an alcoholic, let's say, you know, and it's like, if I don't have booze, I'm gonna go through withdrawal, I'm gonna have DTs, and that causes me so much suffering. So please be compassionate, give me some more money so that I can have another bottle of alcohol. So is that compassion if you give him money for another bottle of alcohol? No, that's stupidity. Yeah. You say to him, I will take you to rehab so that you can overcome your bad habit. I will not give you money for alcohol, but I will take you to rehab. You don't even give him money for rehab because he might take it and spend it for alcohol. But you take the person to rehab and you say, yeah, you get involved in this program and then we'll start talking again. Okay? So just because somebody's going to be unhappy with you because you stop their bad behavior doesn't mean that you're at fault. People are responsible for their own emotions. We're responsible for our actions. Okay. So we're responsible, every individual is responsible for their actions and their own emotions. We are not responsible for somebody else's actions and somebody else's emotions. If they're adults, I mean, if they're kids and you let your kid misbehave, it's a different kind of thing. But as adults, no, everybody has to be responsible for their own thing. Yeah. So if I, with a very mean mind, an angry mind, I say something nasty to somebody and they're hurt because of it, I'm responsible for my mean, nasty motivation. I'm responsible for my non-virtuous speech. Okay? But that person is responsible for their own emotions. Because sometimes I might say something, you're trying to give somebody some feedback, you know, so that they can really learn from a mistake, and they get offended and they get angry at you. Has that ever happened to you? You try and help somebody and they come back and they're angry at you. Yeah, their anger is their responsibility. If we acted with a kind motivation and did our best, that's good enough. Yeah, if they react and they get angry, that is their responsibility. It's not ours. Okay? So this is quite important. There's a thing that they call people-pleasing. Do you have that expression here? You know, being a people-pleaser? You're always running around, are you okay, are you okay, are you okay? Are you okay? And you get so lost in trying to make everybody else okay that you're totally unaware of your own behavior and totally unaware of what's going on inside of you. And the motivation behind checking if everybody is okay is not a sincere wish for them to be happy. It's a wish for them to like us. So I'm always trying to do things so that are nice, not because I really care about people, but so that they will like me. Okay? That's not what the Buddha calls virtue. Okay? The action looks good, but the motivation was really rather self-centered, wasn't it? So we want to make sure that our motivations are really ones of kindness, not ones where we're trying to get people to like us. Because sometimes in the attempt to get other people to like us, we do negative actions. And then we bear the karmic consequences of our own negative actions. Okay. For example, yeah, my relative my relative who's the alcoholic, okay, who's drinking, and they're so drunk they can't go to work. And I feel kind of ashamed being married or, you know, whatever my relationship is with this person who's an alcoholic. So I cover up for him. And I call his job and say, oh, he's sick today, he can't come in and work. When actually, he's completely drunk and passed out. And then I think, oh, I'm being so compassionate. That way he can keep his job, the family doesn't lose face. But is that compassion to cover up for somebody who's passed out? Who's actually harming the family through their addiction? Yeah, it's a difficult situation, but covering up for that person really is not in their best interest or in our own. Okay. So one young man told me that he was probably older, maybe in his 20s or 30s when he said this to me. But when he was a teenager, he was always getting in trouble. And so he would get arrested by the police. They would have a juvenile court thing. His mother would come in and say, you know, pay whatever fee, like if he had stole something or vandalized it. She would pay the fee. She would take him home, you know, out of compassion. And, you know, and then he'd go back to school, and then a few weeks later he would do the same thing again, and they had a juvenile court, and the mother would go again and rescue her son and bring him home. And he told me that one time, you know, after this had happened several times, they were in court, and his mother said to the judge, "Judge, I can't handle my son anymore. He's out of control. You keep him." And the boy was like, and that's what made him start looking at his own behavior. Because as long as his mother kept rescuing him, he didn't have to be responsible for his behavior. But when they took him back to the juvenile detention center, yeah, and he was there because of his own behavior, and mom wasn't rescuing him, then he had to stop and think, why am I here? What did I do? What am I going to do about this situation? And that's what started making him grow up. I can imagine it must have been a horrible situation for the mother, you know, because as a mother, you don't want to leave your child in juvenile hall. But actually, it was the compassionate thing to do, because that's what made him start to change. Okay, so we have to remember that compassion sometimes can mean being very clear and very straightforward with somebody, and they may not initially like what we say, But if we're doing it with a kind motivation, yeah, then it's fine. It's like most of you are parents, right? How many of you are parents? Have kids? Yeah? Okay. If you, every time your child cried and wanted something, if you gave them what they wanted, yeah? Is that being a good parent?
No.
No. It's not, is it? Why not? Yeah. Then your kid grows up and thinks, the world should do everything I want. Mom and Dad gave me everything. Everybody else should do things my way. And the child has no experience in how to deal with frustration. And we all know that frustration happens, doesn't it? We all know that it's impossible for all of our wants and needs to get met. But if your parents don't teach you how to deal with your frustration, and you expect everything to go the way you want, then, you know, and the parent reinforces that by giving the child everything they want, it's actually a handicap for the child when they grow up. My nephew is a wonderful kid. I really love him. He can, and he plays football, so he knows how to get the, you know, balls where he wants them to go. But he can't get his dirty clothes into the hamper. Yeah? They're on the floor, they're on the side of the hamper. He can't get his dirty clothes into the hamper for being washed. You know? And I say to my sister, you know, my sister just picks up after him. He's 19 now, you know, so she's always picked up after him. And I said to her one day, I said, you know, this is creating a difficult situation for him, because when he goes to college and he has roommates, if his roommate wants to live in a clean place, they're going to have a lot of quarrels because, you know, he doesn't know how to pick up after himself. My sister said, well, yeah, that's true, but, you know, he's only home for a little while more, so I'll spoil him. So I'm not sure what's going to happen. Yeah? If he comes up to the Abbey to visit me and his clothes are all over the floor, I'm going to say something. Yeah? Because it's amazing. We find at the Abbey amazing things. Young people who don't know how to sweep a floor. I'm not joking. Seriously. We say, sweep the kitchen. They don't know how to sweep the floor. Yeah. And especially the boys, we say, make your bed. What's that? You know, it's amazing. And this is because the parents have really spoiled them. Then they wind up coming to us. And just recently, we had one of the nuns had to teach two young men in their 20s how to clean the bathroom. Because they didn't know how to clean the bathroom. And they would complain about having a dirty bathroom. But they wouldn't clean it, and they didn't know how to clean it. Because they complained the bathroom's so dirty, we said, clean it. You know? They had no clue how to clean the bathroom. So one of the nuns, yeah, you remember this, yeah? One of the nuns had to take them, and here's the toilet cleaner, and here's the brush, and this is what you do, and here's the shower, this is the stuff you spray, this is how you scrub it, you know. And then she had to supervise him afterwards for a while. Yeah. So parents who just let their kids, who spoil their kids, really do a great disservice to them. Yeah. As a parent, you know, compassion means sometimes you have to say no, and then you don't just say to the kid, "I said no, and you're unhappy, so tough. You know, be quiet, go cry somewhere else." You teach them how to handle their frustration. You say, "Do you feel frustrated?" "Yes, you did this and this." "Okay, you feel frustrated. What do you need?" "I need you to buy me a new sports car." "No, that's not actually what you need." Yeah. "What do you need inside when you feel frustrated?" "I need understanding." "Okay, I understand that you feel frustrated. I know feeling frustrated isn't a very pleasant feeling, but I also know that it's a skill that you're going to have to develop in your life, is learning how to deal with not getting everything that you want." "Well, but I want everything." "Well, yes, and so do I. And we all have to learn that that's not what's going to happen." Okay, so you teach your child how to deal with frustration. Okay, you say, "Yeah, you didn't get what you wanted. Are you going to survive it?" "No, I'm going to die." "You're going to die if you don't get a new sports car?" "Yes." Check up. "Are you really going to die? Come on." Yeah. I've never heard death by getting a sports car. That's not one of the things they put on coroner reports. Okay. Yeah. See, you have to discuss and teach the child. Okay. Okay. Any questions about this before I go on?
Just now you talk about accepting. I think accepting should be accepting on love and not accepting on pity. You were saying about accepting. Mm-hmm. Accepting should be accepting a person back on love and not accepting the person back because you pity the person.
Right. I think that's very good. There's a big difference between compassion and pity. Yeah. Pity is, "Oh, you poor boy. You can't manage your own life." How insulting is that? You know, when we pity people, it's not very respectful of them. It's like, "You can't manage your own life, you poor something. You need me to come and save you. I am so great, I will save you. And remember that you owe me something now." Okay, that's not compassion. Yeah, going along with self-pity trips is not compassion. And sometimes we have to say, "Yes, you're unhappy. And what ideas do you have for remedying your unhappiness?" Compassion can be difficult. Yeah? Compassion can be very difficult because it doesn't mean we always just go along with things. Yeah. And as pity especially is very condescending. Shantideva, a great 8th century Indian sage, talks about how to help other sentient beings. And he says we help them without pitying them. We help them with compassion, but without pity. Okay. And it gives the example of when we step on a thorn, or we step on a piece of glass, or a rusty nail, our hand reaches down and pulls out the thorn or the nail or the shard of glass, bandages the foot, and then life goes on. It's very simple. Yeah? And Shanti Deva says that is how we show compassion to others. Okay. With pity, the hand goes, foot, look at you. You stepped on a rusty nail. Again, how many times have I told you to look out where you're going? And again, stupid foot, you've stepped on a nail and got yourself hurt. But I, the great and glorious hand, I'm going to come and rescue you from your pain. So I pull, the hand pulls the thorn out of the nail. It bandages it up. It kisses it and says, I'm going to make it all better again. Yeah? That's pity. Okay? Because the hand is holding itself supreme. I am the great and glorious hand, and you are the stupid foot. Okay? That's not compassion. Compassion is equal. Yeah? Somebody else's suffering is as severe or is as serious as my suffering. And I take care of it because it's suffering. And I don't claim any kind of special status for myself because I do that. And I don't look down on somebody else for getting themselves in a jam, because I've gotten myself in plenty of jams in my life. Have you gotten yourself in jams sometimes? Have you done stupid things? Some of you are nodding and some of you are Yeah, I've done incredibly stupid things in my life. Yeah. So I know what it's like to do a stupid thing, but I'm certainly not going to encourage somebody else to do something stupid like I did. Yeah. Okay, shall we go back to precious human life? Yeah? Okay. So,
sorry, just one question, right?
Okay.
So because we're in Asia, right, we're very socialistic by culture and value. What it means is that to a lot of extent, we are quite people pleasers. We don't live just for ourselves. We're not very...
Did you say that again?
So because we're socialistic by culture and tradition in Asia, so what that means is that we live just not for ourselves, we make decisions on a very socialistic manner, right?
Yeah.
We live for our parents, our friends, and our community, and we don't make a decision solely because of what I want.
Yeah.
So let's say, for example, you decide, like in Malaysia we're multicultural, but it's like almost taboo to marry another race, mm-hmm. especially the Malays, because it comes so much liabilities to marry a Muslim. So let's say if you believe that this guy is the one for you, but your parents are absolutely against you. Have you done an injustice to your parents? But your intentions are good, you love this man, you just want to be with him, but it caused so much social disaster at home. Mm. Your father's against you, he's going to disown you, you cause almost bickering and complaint and argument every time you come back home, that even your siblings think that you're such a selfish human being for making such a decision for your life. Would it be compassionate of you to break up with this person to bring peace back home?
Mm-hmm. Good question. Did this happen to you? Yeah? No, I understand, because I came from an ethnic minority, and my parents always said, you've got to marry within our ethnic group. You know, you shouldn't marry somebody outside. They make bad husbands. You know. I think this kind of thing you have to really check and see. Yeah. Are you, you know, is it genuine love that you have for this person? Or are you in some way wanting to rebel against your parents? Yeah? Because just the idea of wanting to rebel, that's not so virtuous. But if you genuinely care for this person, you know, then that's fine. Yeah. You have to look at the situation and see, you know, what it is. Are the parents overreacting? Is it something that eventually they'll come around to? Yeah. Because believe it or not, if you give your parents time to grow up, they will. Yeah. When I ordained, my parents were not happy. Yeah. But I knew in the long term that my decision to ordain would be the best thing for them in the long term, yeah? And the best thing for all sentient beings in the long term. That it wasn't something selfish, I was just rebelling and doing it, you know, to be contrary, yeah? So you have to check your own mind, your own motivation. You also have to check and, you know, see how bad is the disharmony at home. Is it something people will slowly get used to? Yeah. And you also have to check, you know, if you're an adult and this is, you know, you're an adult and you should be able to make your own decisions. Yeah. And so, you know, to decide, are you going to make your own decision or do you feel that it's better to do what the family wants? It'll be a personal decision. But doing something out of guilt is not going to be healthy, you know. If you really care about this person or, you know, or you want to ordain or whatever, and your parents are unhappy, and then you feel guilty, oh, they're so unhappy, it's my fault, what a bad person I am. I'm so unappreciative, I'm really bad. And then you do what they want, but you have a sense of resentment because of it. In the end, that's not gonna bring about a healthy relationship with your parents because you're gonna be acting from resentment. But on the other hand, if you actually look and you say, my parents are unhappy, and my parents, you know, they're a good judge of character. I've seen them, you know, evaluate other people, and they know how to evaluate people well, and I trust their opinion. So I need to really think some more about what they say because, you know, I trust their ideas. Okay? So do you see there's so many different nuances and different feelings, different thoughts involved, and we have to see what's actually going on in our own mind. But one thing to remember is it's impossible to please somebody else. Yeah? It's impossible. We cannot expect somebody else to totally please us, and we should not expect ourselves to totally please somebody else. Because we're sentient beings and we have fickle minds. And what pleases somebody today makes them unhappy tomorrow. So if you're living your life just to please other people, you know, you're likely to carry a lot of resentment that will come out in other ways. On the other hand, if you really respect their opinion, you respect their judgment, then stopping and thinking about what they're doing, incorporating what they say into your decision-making process, that can be very wise. So, His Holiness continues here. He says, we know that Shakyamuni Buddha lived and taught in ancient India, and that many Buddhist sages such as Nagarjuna, Asanga, and Shantideva gained extraordinary qualities by following in the Buddha's footsteps. Their pure ethical conduct, meditative experience, wisdom, and great humility are evident in their life stories and the treatises they authored. These and many other Buddhist sages did not become renowned by becoming war heroes or financial tycoons. Rather, they observed a life of restraint and humility and benefited others. Through this, without seeking fame, they became well-known role models for subsequent generations of practitioners. Yeah, so it's true, the people that we look up to as Buddhist sages, as you know, the highly accomplished practitioners, they weren't looking out for fame. They weren't trying to prove themselves. They acted with a virtuous intention. If we reflect on the nature of their precious human lives and our own, we do not find much difference. Everyone has the same human potential. As human beings, we have unique intelligence compared with other life forms, regardless of our nationality, gender, race, ethnicity, sexual orientation, social class, religion, and so on. Everyone has the same Buddha nature. Siddhartha Gautama was an ordinary human being just like us. By tapping into and using his human potential in the right way, he became a Buddha and was able to greatly benefit sentient beings living at that time, as well as those in many centuries to come. Even today, we hear of and encounter people who offer great service and benefit to mankind. We have the ability to do the same. Because so His Holiness is saying that, you know, we shouldn't think poorly of ourselves and say, I can't do this is too difficult. The Buddha got enlightened, but, you know, he's special, I can't do it. You know, His Holiness is saying, no, all of us have the same human potential. And sometime in a past life, we used to hang out with the previous continuum of Shakyamuni Buddha. We used to, you know, hang out at the beach or the disco. Yeah, I mean, we've had beginningless times. We've known each other, you know, in different roles in the past. But that continuity became a Buddha, and we're still hanging out in samsara. Why? Yeah, because that continuity practiced the Dharma, and we just kept going to the beach and going to the disco, and we didn't practice Dharma. Okay, but the human potential is the same, so we should never ever put ourselves down. Yeah, it's very important to remember our precious human life. I have found, this is His Holiness speaking, I have found in my discussions with people that many people suffer from low self-esteem and self-hatred. When we reflect on our spectacular good fortune in having a precious human life, these distorted conceptions vanish. We have all 18 factors of a precious human life, so obviously we are a worthwhile and adequate person. I'm going to read that again. Take some repetition. We have all 18 factors of a precious human life, so obviously we are a worthwhile and adequate person. We created tremendous constructive karma in previous lives to have our present opportunity, So we are capable of Dharma practice. We have all necessary conditions to progress on the path and accomplish our spiritual aims in this life. So seeing the future as bleak is unrealistic. Consistent meditation on precious human life prevents us from such self-defeating and inaccurate ways of viewing ourselves. To the contrary, it generates great enthusiasm for Dharma practice. Okay? So this is why this meditation on precious human life is so important. Okay, the whole paragraph?
The 18 precious, 18 factors.
Okay, from the law, where he talks about, let's see. Well, let me just read the whole paragraph. I have found in my discussions with people that many suffer from low self-esteem and self-hatred. When we reflect on our spectacular good fortune in having a precious human life, these distorted conceptions vanish. We have all 18 factors of a precious human life. So obviously, we are a worthwhile and adequate person. We created tremendous constructive karma in previous lives to have our present opportunity, so we are capable of Dharma practice. We have all necessary conditions to progress on the path and accomplish our spiritual aims in this life. So seeing the future as bleak is unrealistic. Consistent meditation on precious human life prevents us from such self-defeating and inaccurate ways of viewing ourselves. To the contrary, it generates great enthusiasm for Dharma practice.
Okay. Yeah, this is to leave what you started off by saying, the compassion, remembering the genocide, but not to, first of all, is to acknowledge that the genocide, but it doesn't mean that's right. Mm-hmm. Compassion towards someone and the precious human life. Now, the issue bothering me is about a macro picture. Let's say in case of the Myanmar right now, there is this active drive to chase the undocumented group of people called Rohingya out of the state. Mm-hmm. And His Holiness has also called for the leadership of Myanmar to do something about it, because it actually would also mean equivalent to genocide in some way.
Yeah.
I just wonder, you know, I feel quite hopeless from outside. What could be done in this context? Because we are not in this leadership position, a political position, or whatever it is, right? So how do we view a macro situation like this, which is actually not ideal, in the context of compassion and recognizing the precious human life that are being kind of wasted?
Okay, so you're asking what can we do with in terms of the Rohingya crisis? Yeah, what can we do as Buddhists? I think one thing is it's important that we speak out and say what the Burmese government is doing is wrong. Okay, that what the monks, because there's some monks who are speaking in very prejudiced ways against the Muslims, making false accusations, stirring up fear and hatred. We must say that what those monks are saying is not the Buddha's teaching. Okay? And we need to say this fearlessly. Yeah. Because the Buddha never talked about there being justice and prejudice and in violence and in cruelty. He always talked about peace. So if some people, even though they call themselves Buddhists, if they're not acting in accordance with the Buddha's words, we need to say so. Yeah. And it's difficult to know as people who live outside Burma what exactly to do. Our community wrote a letter to the Burmese embassy in Washington, D.C., outlining our reasons for why we disagree with what they're doing, and everybody in our community signed it. Yeah. So we felt that was one thing we could do, just to register, our protest about what the generals are doing. So we've also talked about that a lot. We have a lot of videos on the internet, because every day we give a short Dharma talk called Bodhisattva Breakfast Corner, BBC, and we put it on the web, and many people have written to us about with a question like yours. And so because of that, then more people have written to us, and one man who works in the field of reconciliation, he wrote to us and he said, "Do you know about anybody in Burma, who is open to reconciliation, who we can contact and get some discussions started?" So we had heard from somebody in Burma, about what the situation was. We tried to put them in touch as best as we could. I'm not sure what actually happened. Did they write back to you? Do you know? You don't know either. Okay. Yeah. But I think definitely writing to the Burmese embassy, in Malaysia, and saying, we, as Buddhists, we disagree with what you're doing.
So what happened to the monk, because the so-called monk is Viratu, right?
The so-called what?
So the so-called monk,
is
known as Viratu. And in fact, I was just with some Myanmar people, some of those, in the business circle, and they don't even call him a monk. They just call him the bald-head guy.
Oh, really?
Yeah, because they regard him as a monk.
Yeah.
So I'm just wondering, from the Buddhist circle, from especially the Sangha circle, what could be done to address this? Because it has been turned into a religious issue, a political issue, actually.
Yeah. And what's especially bad about this is that the Islamic extremists will really turn it into a religious issue and exploit it. That will make the situation much worse. I mean, it seems to me all we can do as a Buddhist community is just really say, what this person, what these monks who talk like that are doing is not the Buddhist teachings. We disagree. They need to go back and go back and study more and do some meditation and speak the Buddha's words and not mislead people. I mean, it seems to me the only thing we can do is to vocalize our dissent with what's happening. If you know people in Burma and you have contacts with the military or the government or whatever, then you can speak directly to those people and maybe try and explain other courses of action. But, aside from that, maybe some demonstrations in front of the embassy, but I don't think people here would be as, that's your way of doing things. In America, we go and demonstrate all the time. But here, maybe it's not your way.
Do we make that proclamation that
We can't say that, because it's not up to us to say whether somebody's keeping their precepts or not. We can say he's not talking the words of the Buddha. Yeah, but we don't know if he's keeping his precepts or not keeping his precepts. So that's not for us to say. Yeah, but we could say he's not speaking in the way that monks should speak. He's not acting in a way that the Buddha wanted his sangha to act. Okay.
Can I ask, can you relate it to the cause and effect from cause and effect point of view on these matters?
Mm-hmm. You mean the Rohingya situation?
Yes.
Yeah. So from the karmic viewpoint, okay. So looking at it, you know, we would look, and certainly the generals in Myanmar are creating incredible negative karma. Yeah? They're burning people's homes, evicting them from their place, causing people a lot of suffering. They're creating a lot of negative karma. Okay? From the side of the Rohingyas, they're experiencing the result of negative karma that they created in previous lives. That doesn't mean they deserve to suffer, it just means they created the cause. If we look at the situation from a large perspective, we see that everybody in the situation is involved in samsaric dukkha. Some people are experiencing the results of negative karma, other people are creating negative karma. And they'll experience the result of their negative karma later on. So we can't really say in a big way that certain people are innocent and certain people are guilty. That's not the way we should look at it. You know, we should look at it like everyone is under the influence of ignorance, anger, and attachment. Everybody is acting, is controlled by their afflictions and karma. And the real, actual remedy for the situation is to eliminate ignorance. Yeah. The temporary remedy for the situation is compassion for everybody involved. Okay. It's the same way when other people harm us, yeah, if they have a nasty motivation, they're creating negative karma, we're experiencing the result of our own negative karma. We're both stuck in samsara. Yeah, everybody needs to practice and try and get out of the situation. Yeah. I mean, this is why the fourth point that turns our mind to the Dharma is the thinking about the disadvantages of samsara, the dukkha of samsara. And this is precisely why the Buddha pointed all of that out to us. So that we would see that the real remedy is to get out of samsara by overcoming ignorance. Yeah. The real remedy is not just trying to tweak our samsara and make it a little bit better. Because as long as we're under the influence of ignorance, anger, and attachment, one form of dukkha or another is always going to afflict us. Okay, now what I want to do is switch to another book. Yeah? So this book is another one that came out just this last year. It's called Practical Ethics and Profound Emptiness. And it's a commentary by one of my teachers. His name is Geshe Jampa Tepchok, or Kenzer Jampa Tepchok, because he's the former abbot of one of the big monasteries in India. And the commentary is on Nagarjuna's text, Ratnavali, or Precious Garland. Yeah, so this is a text that's found in the Chinese canon and in the Tibetan canon. And it's written by Nagarjuna, very famous Buddhist saint or sage of the second century India. And it's really a spectacular text. And so Nagarjuna talked about the causes for attaining a precious human life. So I wanted just to speak about those briefly, because if we understand what the causes are, then that gives us a lot of power, because then we know what actions we need to do that will create the karma to ripen in a precious human life, and what actions we need to abandon so that we don't create causes for unfortunate lives. Okay? So I'm going to read a little bit from Nagarjuna, and then maybe a little bit from Kensur Jangpa Tenchu, or it might be shorter if I comment on it myself. Okay, so verse 7 in this text, the text has 500 verses, and Nagarjuna is speaking to a king, okay? So he says, a wise person is one who, having accurately analyzed all actions of body, speech, and mind, always acts for the benefit of self and others. This is four lines, but it's very profound, okay? So you want to know what wisdom is, who a wise person is? It's somebody who has accurately analyzed, okay? So they've thought about it, they've discerned, yeah? And looked at their own actions, physical, verbal, and mental actions. And they've been able to see what actions are done with a kind motivation, what are done with a vindictive motivation. Yeah? What actions bring happiness in the long term to sentient beings, or what actions bring suffering in the long term to sentient beings. And the conclusion from all this analysis is of how to act, such a person always acts for the benefit of self and others. Okay. So we act in ways that don't just benefit ourselves, but also benefit others. And we don't just act in ways that benefit others, those ways have to benefit ourselves. Now, benefit doesn't mean make more money or be more popular or have more worldly power. That's not the definition of benefit. Benefit is in terms of what are virtuous actions that will lead to the kinds of results in the future that we want. Okay? So, if we act with a kind heart, with wisdom, and do actions that benefit other sentient beings, we automatically benefit ourselves because our motivation is good, our action is clean, clear, the other person's beneficial, benefited, okay? On the other hand, if an action benefits me, like I make a lot of money from it, but it harms somebody else because they got cheated out of their money. That's not going to be an action that is wise. Okay? Just working for our own interest alone and harming others is not wise. Okay? On the other hand, if an action harms both me and other people, definitely it should be abandoned. If an action harms somebody else, and it doesn't really benefit me, but it also doesn't harm me, then it's good to do. Okay? So we have to understand about karma so we can make good decisions in our life. And not just make decisions based on emotion, based on impulsiveness. So then Nagarjuna continues here. And he says, here he's talking about the actions that create the cause of happiness and those that create the cause of suffering, or for a higher rebirth and a lower rebirth. He says, refraining from killing and from stealing, not engaging in adultery, restraining from lying, divisive speech, harsh speech, and idle talk. Abandoning covetousness, malice, and nihilistic views. These are the 10 bright paths of action. The 10 gloomy ones are the opposite. So that's what I mentioned in the previous session about the 10 non-virtuous actions. And then their opposite is restraining from doing them, or even doing the opposite. So instead of killing, we keep the precept to not kill. Or better yet, we save lives. Yeah. Regarding stealing, abandoning stealing is, and keeping that precept is a virtuous action. And then also, so is protecting other people's belongings. Okay, so he talks about those 10 that we should abandon, 10 that we should practice. Then, okay, so that was verse 8 and 9 in the text. Verse 10, he says, in brief, Dharma consists of not taking intoxicants, maintaining a proper livelihood, abandoning harm, being respectfully generous, honoring the worthy, and cultivating love. So in addition to those 10 to abandon, and by practicing restraining from them, and also practicing the opposite, Nagarjuna talks about 6 more actions that we want to either restrain from doing or do, that will create the cause for a good human rebirth. Okay, so first one, not taking intoxicants. I think some of you want me to skip that one and talk about the next one. Yeah, and why does the Buddha talk about not taking intoxicants? It's because when we take intoxicants, we lose our good judgment, and we say and we do really stupid things. Okay. So I told you that I work a lot with people who are incarcerated because of crimes. I would say 99% of them were intoxicated at the time they committed their crime that got them imprisoned. Okay. Intoxication is not an excuse. That doesn't excuse somebody from committing a crime. But intoxication can be something that encourages people to act in ways that they normally would not act. Okay? So, many of us have been intoxicated at one time or another. Have you ever been intoxicated? Yeah, I've been intoxicated. I wasn't born a nun. Yeah, I was a layperson at one time. I know what goes on in the world. Yeah, and I also know from my own experience of getting intoxicated that I say and do stupid things. Yeah, that I wish I hadn't said and done. So this is why the Buddha, said abandon intoxicants, because that's the way we act. Now some people say, well, I don't really get intoxicated, I just have one drink. Well, that's how you get intoxicated. You take one drink, and then you take one drink, and then you take one drink. And before you know it, there's a series of one drinks and you're out to lunch. Okay? So it's just, I like Alcoholics Anonymous. I think they really have it good. They say no, no alcohol, or, you know, Narcotics Anonymous, no, you know, recreational drugs. Yeah, no abuse of pain medication. Because it's hard to discern when exactly is the point where you get intoxicated. And when does it turn into abuse? Yeah, it's very hard to discern. So it's better just stop the whole thing. Some of you are looking at me like, yeah, yeah. Okay. I don't know if it's a problem here, but in my country, there's an opioid epidemic of people who are overdosing on different opioid drugs and dying. Incredible. Really, it's a huge health problem now. Many of these people got hooked on opioids, heroin, fentanyl, because they started out taking pain medication and they got addicted to pain medication. Because the pharmaceutical companies said, oh, these medications aren't really so addictive if they're taken in moderation. And, you know, and they started giving the doctors samples and encouraging the doctors to prescribe pain medication. And so the doctors did, and the pharmaceutical companies made tons of money, and as a result, a lot of people got addicted to the opioid drugs. When they couldn't get them legally anymore through prescription, then they started going on the streets and getting heroin. And then there's this synthetic opioid called fentanyl that started getting mixed in with the heroin. And fentanyl is so strong that it's like just a few, it looks like salt, and just a few grains of it mixed in with heroin, somebody can OD on that and die. And so they're finding, you know, young people, old people sitting on the streets, you know, overdosing from these drugs. It's a huge problem in the States now, okay? So, you know, we shouldn't think just alcohol, yeah? Abusing pain medication can be very, very serious. Okay, I'm gonna go through the others. I'll try and go through them quickly, okay? That's intoxicants. Maintaining a proper livelihood. That means earning our living honestly. Yeah, telling the truth, not cheating people. Okay. Now, when I go to Singapore, many people say, but you have to lie in order to do business. Yeah, and my boss wants me to lie. And, you know, I had a friend who was an executive in Hong Kong for Levi Strauss Company. And I asked her about this, and I said, you know, does lying really make your business better? And she said no, because if you lie, you may get a better deal now, but people are not gonna come back to you to do business because they'll realize that you cheated them. If you tell them the truth, you may make less money immediately, but those people will come back and do business with you. They will recommend you to friends. And so in the long term, it pays off. Okay? So maintaining a proper livelihood. And not doing business in like weapons, poisons, things like that that harm people. And not knowingly polluting the world. If you're involved in, you know, a factory and you know that what you're doing is polluting and you're not taking care of it, that I would consider that wrong livelihood. Yeah. Okay, and then the third one, abandoning harm. So not harming other living beings, including all those bugs in your house. Okay? Including your children who are a pain in the neck. Who you love so dearly. Okay? Then the fourth one, being respectfully generous. Yeah? So being generous, helping other people, sharing what you have, you know? Giving not only to Buddhist organizations and monasteries and sanghas and dharma centers, but also giving to the poor, to the needy, to refugees, and so on. Okay, so being generous. And being respectfully generous. So when we give something, it's not just take that, you know, or oh, you poor slob, you're so poor, I'm going to give you some money here. No, we give with respect for other people. Then the fifth is honoring the worthy. So people who were wise, yeah, people who we admire because of their wisdom, because of their compassion, yeah, who have the correct view, who encourage realistic and beneficial actions, honoring those people. Honoring people, it doesn't mean that you all, that you go around bowing to everybody, okay? But the way you speak, the way you act, you show respect to people who you admire, who are worthy of respect. And that has the effect of opening your own mind to generate the qualities that the other people have. And then the sixth one is cultivating love. So, of course, if we cultivate love, love is wanting others or somebody, could be ourselves too, to have happiness and the causes of happiness. So cultivating love, if we really spend some time on it, then it becomes very difficult to hold grudges against other people. And then our mind, the spontaneous way that we act with others is with a kind heart. So whenever we meet somebody, we come to them with a kind heart, without suspicion, yeah, without malice, without mistrust, but with a kind heart. Okay? So those are the 16 things that Nagarjuna talks about. As 16, you know, certain ones to abandon, certain ones to practice, to create the causes for a precious human life, which we all want to do. Okay. Now, when we create these causes, we don't just dedicate the merit for a precious human life. We dedicate the merit for the enlightenment of all living beings. And because we've dedicated for a very broad purpose and scope, then included within that comes having a good rebirth. Okay? And so that's what we're going to do right now is dedicate. Yeah, because we've reached the conclusion of our afternoon. And we will continue tomorrow. So there's, do you want to put it on the board? Okay. There's a chant that we do in English to dedicate. So if they really feel happy that you spent the afternoon, or you spent the whole day creating so much merit, and, you know, rejoice at your merit and at the merit of everybody here today, and then let's dedicate all this merit. Due to this merit, may we soon attain the awakened state of Guru Buddha, that we may be able to liberate all sentient beings. beings from their suffering. May the precious Bodhi mind, not yet born, arise and grow. May the born have no decline, but increase forever.